You're listening to Sound Opinions once again, recording each of us in isolation. This week, we are talking with singer, songwriter, and super producer, Rafael Sadiq. But Greg, first we have some sad news. After a battle that lasted a couple of weeks, John Prine, singer-songwriter originally from the Chicago area, passed as a result of a battle with COVID-19.
Yes, Jim, sad indeed. John Prine dead at the age of 73. Had a remarkable career that began in the late 60s in the Chicago folk scene and was soon championed by people like Kris Kristofferson and Bob Dylan, among others. We had a great opportunity to speak with him a couple of years ago when he was coming off one of the triumphs of his career, the Tree of Forgiveness record, his first one in more than a decade that won all sorts of accolades. And John stopped by our studio and we were able to have a great conversation with him.
There's a hole in Daddy's arm where all the money goes. Jesus Christ died for nothing, I suppose.
The famous story about John Prine as he started out delivering the mail in Maywood, Illinois. And on his route, he was writing these songs, including some stone-cold classics like Sam Stone and Hello in There. This guy wrote a bunch of tunes, finally debuted them at a club in Chicago, was reviewed by none other than Roger Ebert, the famed film critic.
My friend and colleague.
Caught a show. It was one of the first big reviews that Prine got. His career took off from there.
The list of people who look up to John Prine, Johnny Cash,
yeah.
Bonnie Raitt, Kris Kristofferson, Paul Westerberg, Dwight Yoakam, oh yeah, and that guy Bob Dylan. You know, those are some of the many admirers. I think that there are artists who are songwriters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after Townes Van Zandt, number two on that list is John Prine. You know, John had a really tough battle with cancer in 1998 on the right side of his neck. It left his voice deeper, more gravelly. You'll hear that when we're talking to him. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So, John, let's start at the beginning of your career. You know, I mean, you're working as this postal carrier in your 20s, and during this time, you're writing these amazing multi-layered songs. How did that work?
Not to put down the job of a mailman, but once you know that route, there's nothing you're like in a library with no books. All day long, you got all this time on your hands to think about stuff. It was a perfect, I need to be doing something else when I'm writing.
Mm-hmm.
I can't be thinking that I'm actually a writer and sitting there, well, I'm going to write a song today. Only once did I deliver the mail to the wrong street, every house on the wrong street.
That must have been a day that gave you a particularly good song.
And I had to go back at 8 o'clock at night and knock on every door and get the mail back. It was very embarrassing for a mailman. Yeah.
When I woke up this morning, things were looking bad. Seemed like total silence was the only friend I had. Bowl of oatmeal tried to stare me down and won. Knew it was 12 o'clock before I realized I was having no fun.
I'm curious too, John, because you got up on stage at the Fifth Peg in the Old Town neighborhood and when the folk scene was starting to explode, and you played like three songs, I guess, and they blew everybody away. You're writing these masterpieces like almost like your first public performance, and you're doing songs like Hello in there, right? And Sam Stone was in there. How many songs did you have to write in your head before you got to a place where you're writing songs of that quality, or was it just pouring
not
out?
Not many.
Yeah?
Yeah. I started writing when I was 14, and then it was totally a hobby. But I found some of those songs when I did my second album, Diamond in the Rough, and I cut two of the songs I wrote when I was 14 years old. I found a tape of me singing The Frying Pan, Sour Grapes, and Twist and Shout. And I knew that I didn't write Twist and Shout. So I cut the other two. And they were the same as the kind of stuff that I was writing at 24.
Wow.
I don't care if the sun don't shine, but better all people will wonder. No man, if it ever quits raining, except the kids are afraid of the thunder, see sour grapes. You can laugh and stare, see sour grapes. I don't care.
I after the Army is when I started writing again. I kind of dropped it. It was just a hobby. And I started writing when I got home from the Army early 68. So 68 and 69 were just about the whole first record.
You got a lot of notice early on. Roger Ebert famously wrote up your show, and Kris Kristofferson was in the audience, blown away. There was an immediate sort of, you know, hubbub around John Prine and this great new folk singer. What sort of pointed you in the direction of, you know, that acoustic guitar and writing those folk songs versus, you know, just doing a rock and roll band in Chicago in the late 60s?
Well, my oldest brother, Dave Prine, who still lives out in Maywood, Dave taught me how to play when I was 14. He was into old-timey music, like New Lost City Ramblers.
I'm going where there's no depression, to the lovely land that's free from care. I'll leave this world of toil and trouble. My home's in heaven, I'm going there.
And Dave taught me rhythm guitar so he could practice his fiddle. If you've ever been around somebody who's teaching himself how to play the fiddle, you have to be a loved one. Oh. Otherwise, you run.
Boy, it's brutal.
It is painful.
But he taught me how to play really fast rhythm, and it was all old-timey country.
Mm-hmm.
So what I maintained, because I was a huge rock and roll fan, if somebody were taught me Chuck Berry, how to play the guitar like Chuck Berry's songs, I would be writing in a whole different genre.
Mm-hmm.
But he taught me about folk. He laid a couple of records on me, Carter Family.
Out in the cold world and far away from home, somebody's boy is wandering alone.
John Hurt, Elizabeth Cotton, and I learned their style of picking. And I learned about five Carter Family songs, and I started writing songs.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Boom. It was too hard for me to memorize their words. So I wrote my own words to other tunes, and then started writing my own tunes.
You know, the other thing that was interesting to me about your early career is there must have been a certain amount of push to, like, you know, let's go a little more rock. Let's anthem up these songs a little bit. Let's put some rock instrumentation on there. You seem to always resist that impulse to get that anthemic quality into the songs. There was no easy sing-alongs there necessarily in terms of just like a rock song.
Right.
Your songs always struck me as kind of being emotionally ambiguous. Like you didn't tell the listener how to feel. And you certainly couldn't write a chorus that was going to be shouted up in an arena, like, you know.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to tell the record companies this at the time, but now that I look back, I got a pretty good view of what I did now and why I did it, and I didn't want a hit. Mm-hmm. To me, a hit was like that's a bookmark in your career, so you're never going to be as good as that hit.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have a hit, you got longevity, you know, and I thought I had some the kind of perfect balance to have really good stuff coming in from the critics and have an audience that did not care. Well, when I started my own record company, people sent in money for the next record. I hadn't read it. I hadn't named it.
Mm-hmm.
They sent in money and said, whatever you do, send me the next record. Here's $15. You can't beat that.
Yeah.
So take it back. Take it back. Oh, no, you can't say that. All of my friends are not dead. O-N-G, yeah, do. Rock and stone, the black wind still moans. Sweet revenge without fail.
Through the 70s, Prine was putting out a great album almost every year. And then things cooled down a little bit in the 80s. He had a lot of life changes that came about in the 80s and 90s. He married his wife, Fiona. He became a dad. He battled cancer. Throughout all this time, he was still putting out records at a less prolific pace. But when he did put them out, they always seemed to be one of those, hey, John Prine's not only still around, he's still got it.
Mm.
And I think one of the classics from that period, from 1991 specifically, was The Missing Years, which was produced by the late Howie Epstein of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. So I asked him about that album.
What happened was when I went to do The Missing Years, after two albums on Old Boy, Sony approached us with a really fat deal, like a lot of money.
Mm.
you know, and I hadn't been with a major label since 79 at the time. This was the late 80s. So I tossed around, you know, maybe we should, maybe we shouldn't. What are we going to do, you know, with old boy? And I stopped in at a party, a Sony party in L.A., and Yetnikoff, I think, was the head there.
Legendary record man, Walter Yetnikoff.
Yeah, more cocaine than records.
Yeah.
And I walk into this party, and one of the vice presidents at Sony slaps me on the back and says, "Welcome aboard." And at that moment, I knew that I never wanted to be on a boat with any of those guys.
Yeah.
So I said, "Let's go with old boy."
Standing by peaceful waters. Standing by peaceful waters.
You know, I wanted to get back to the point about the ambiguity of your a lot of your songs, and I don't mean that as a diss in any way. It's to me like a real strength of it, is that you don't tell the listener how to feel about a song, and you, there's a lot of conflicting emotions and gray areas in your song. Where does that impulse come from? Because it's a gift. You can't. Not everybody can pull that off. It's usually black and white. I'm in love. She broke my heart.
Yeah.
I'm really mad, or I'm really sad. You know. And you know, you've never written a song, like, or not too many songs like that.
I know. But both Steve Goodman and myself always really respected our audiences. And to the point of, I think that I never tell them that they might want to know from me what the song's about, but it's just what it's about from my point of view. I never discount what the song means to them. And boy, some of the stories I get, you know, really, I mean, entire families. I got a letter the other day about this guy's mother and father divorced a long time ago, and the only time they talk on the phone is when I put out a new record. they speak in my lyrics. Yeah.
I saw you mentioned something about families, too, in an interview with Pitchfork. The notion that mom passes your music along to her daughter,
right,
and father to son, and a good buddy of mine who's also a music writer and a union activist said, you know, this is the story of my life. You know, grandfather turned his mother onto her, onto you, and then I mean, that's like kind of magical.
I feel like it's a real honest way for your music to get around, mm-hmm, as opposed to having a radio hit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost like campfire songs, and they get passed down. You know, it's what folk music is supposed to be about.
In spite of ourselves, we'll end up sitting on a rainbow. Against all odds, honey, we're the big door prize. We're gonna spike our noses right off of our faces. There won't be nothing but big old hearts dancing in our eyes.
That was part of our conversation with the great singer-songwriter John Prine. In 2018, Greg, I think few interviews over the history of Sound Opinions we've had as many laughs doing with John.
Indeed.
In the studio. Dead now at the age of 73.
As always, we want to hear from you. What effect has John Prine's music had on your life? Call and leave a message on our hotline, 888-859-1800. Or you can find us on Twitter and Facebook.
We had an apartment in the city. Me and Loretta like living there.
Coming up, a conversation with soulful singer, songwriter, producer Rafael Sadiq. That's after the break on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Left us alone.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis with my partner, Greg Kot. Both of us socially distancing, everybody on the line remote. And that is a little bit of the song Anniversary by Tony, featuring our guest this week, R&B artist Rafael Sadiq. Raphael was born Charles Ray Wiggins in Oakland, California in 1966, part of a large family, many of whom were musical. And by 1977, he was the bassist in a band called the Gospel Hummingbirds out of Oakland. Beginning in 1988, his first major group, Tony, 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 formed with his brother Dwayne and cousin Timothy Christian Riley, charted a number of R&B hits, including Feels Good and the song we played earlier, the slow jam classic Anniversary. The band dissolved in 1996. Sadly, I miss him. And after a stint in R&B supergroup Lucy Pearl, he began a fruitful solo career, all the while producing records for artists ranging from D'Angelo and Solange to John Legend and even John Mellencamp.
His most recent album, Jimmy Lee, made my Best of 2019 list last year. And Jim, I was bummed that I wasn't able to take part in this interview, but one of our producers, Ayana Contreras, stepped in for me. And you two started the interview by asking about why Raphael decided to pick up the bass at the age of six.
I think there was a lot of people responsible for me picking up a bass, but when I really contribute to my it's my brother Dwayne.
Dwayne.
Yeah, he was pretty much a guitar. He was a guitar player. My dad sort of had a guitar in the house,
mm-hmm.
and my uncle Elijah, he had a house full of instruments. So it seemed like every house I walked into had.
He was the gospel musician.
He was
the
gospel
right?
guy, yeah. right? And he had it was always musicians around, and my neighborhood was sort of infested with musicians.
Do you feel like the way you see it, even beyond Motown and things like that, is inspired by where you grew up and the music that was coming there? So like Walter Hawkins.
100%. Like Walter is a big part of my piano. I'm trying to play like the Hawkins family. Larry Graham was my childhood idol. I actually ran into Larry when I was 12 years old at a Walgreens. It wasn't Walgreens then. And I was going on a snow trip, and I was going to buy some mittens from my hands. And I walked in the store, and Larry was walking in the store, him and this girl, lady named Chocolate, who was in Grand Central Station. I just like was running around the store, looking, peeking, and that's when, you know, he had the huge hair wig on and the platforms, the tight leather stuff, with the platforms huge.
And he's going to buy Q-tips, you know, at the drugstore.
Yeah, he had like a Thunderbird, black suicide doors. And so right out the front door was where they would park parallel, and the bus stop was right here. So after I looked so much, I just ran outside and sat at the bus stop, and I sat on top. He came outside. Instead of going to the car, they walked to the bus stop where I was at, and they both walked up to me. Because I guess they saw me.
Yeah, yeah.
And he walked up to me and said, how you doing? And I said, are you Larry Graham? I knew of him. He's like, yeah, I'm Larry. And she's like, I'm Chocolate. I was just like freaking out, and I was like, nice to meet you, I'm a bass player. And I was like 12 maybe, and then I met him years later at Eddie Murphy's house, because he was playing
sounds like a Chappelle skit,
right? And I was playing for him, and I told him up the story. And then I was in a band with his son, a band called Hot Water years before that. I think back in those days, I think it was more about musicianship, you know. In schools they had, you know, stage bands, jazz bands.
How important do you think that having access to music at school was? Every musician we ever interview is like, if I hadn't had that, I might not have had this lifelong passion, and it's dwindling all the time now.
Yeah, true. I mean, I think it's very important. I think every kid needs activities, whatever activities. I think you know, the neighborhood, the home needs to be filled with activities, because, you know, idle time you could get into wrong things. And, you know, kids are a little, you know, when you're a kid, you know, the things that seem bad seems fun. An abandoned house just sounds fun to just climb through a window.
Yeah. Whereas music is one of those constructive, fun, bad things.
Yeah. Well, you can just, you know, get three guys. You play drums. Yeah. I play bass.
Yeah.
You know a guy that plays guitar.
Yeah.
And then we know another guy that sings. So my neighborhood was that way.
I'm thinking of my mom, you know, used to let me rehearse with the drums in the basement, and the china cabinet would rattle.
Yeah.
And God bless her. She was just like, I know where he is.
Of course. Yeah. That was it for me. Garage bands were everything, you know.
Yeah.
I think music in the school is so important. It helps kids to, like, you know, find their personality, find their vibe, find their soul, their energy, and get to meet people and actually learn from other musicians. Because, you know, my school was a lot of great singers. I didn't sing in school. I just played for different people, and I learned to sing through other people.
Is there a song you heard early on that really blew your mind? You know, one of those Desert Island tracks where you just said, like, this is, like, if I can ever do anything like this.
I don't think I ever listened to any music and any song and thought about, I wish I could produce or write something like that. I couldn't get to, like, me doing it.
Yeah.
It was already so good, you know, like, to listen to, like, you know, Pride and Joy by Marvin Gaye.
Mm.
That song, I didn't think about me even playing it or singing it. I just, in the moment of whatever this is, it's making me feel really good. And like Free the Pain, Band of Gold, you know, when you hear chords and harmonies like that, you just, it just makes you dance inside. So
it's on a different planet.
Oh yeah, you're just gone.
Now that you're gone.
I can't think about me ever playing it or producing it. I was just caught up in it. And then all of a sudden you end up with a bass in your hand and you start learning songs. And then you say, oh, maybe I can learn the songs that made me feel really great. And I think that was it for me. I didn't really come on as a, you know, producer, writer, singer, or any of that.
Yeah.
It was just all about loving what, you know, the art world had preserved, jazz, and, you know, classical songs, spirituals, Negro spirituals, and so everything that had a harmony, I could just listen. I would just, it was a problem for me too, because I would be in class and I couldn't retain a paragraph because I would hear for half the paragraph, I read it, and then the next one I'm hearing music.
Right, right.
So then I have to go back over and read it again.
You know, one of the things we've been chasing after you for a long time to do a career retrospective interview. We are super excited about Jimmy Lee. We reviewed that on the show when it came out, and it nicely dovetails in the talking to you about the birth of your interest in music and your upbringing surrounded by so much music, and now this new solo album, which is very personal about that upbringing in part, right?
Yeah, of course.
They kind of dovetail there. You had a big family. Oakland, and Jimmy Lee was one of your older brothers, died a tragic death, a heroin addict. He was infected with HIV. But I've seen interviews where you said you didn't even realize.
No, I didn't even realize it. No, I had to learn that it was heroin. I didn't even know.
That was just your brother.
Just my brother,
Heart is always racing for something.
Watching Fame, like, from the very beginning.
Okay.
And I just keep thinking back to Gene Anthony Ray's character, Leroy, and how he talked about, this is the thing I'm living for. And he had a brother on the show that was only on one episode that had, you know, gone to jail and been through a lot of struggles. And someone was saying, you got to get him, cut him out of your life. You got to cut him out of your life because he's going to bring you down. And Leroy said something really... touching. He said, he just doesn't have something like I have to live for. he never found that thing that drives him, that keeps him going.
When I get up in the morning, I'm coming in here not just to dance. I'm not just coming in here. Because the dancing and the working is, it's not just something that I do. It's something that I am. See, and Willa don't have nothing like that.
And I'm not trying to pull it way out of
No, well, that's sort of what
place.
Jimmy Lee is
but
about.
Yeah, I mean, it's reminding me sort of that moment on that fictional TV show, but very real sentiment.
Yeah, definitely. Our life was definitely like that. We're 14 years apart, I think. And I say in my show that we had two very different lives, and I found something that was the golden light. It had nothing to do with money. This just had something to do with completion. You know, I felt very complete every day. And, you know, like I said, out of time, you create these other avenues. And his thing was, you know, from what my mom said, he was pretty much addicted to heroin at, you know, 14 years old, 14, yeah. 15. And our lives were so different. And when I realized that it was sort of too late, he was gone. And then I started thinking, like, you know, what if we'd had the opportunity to sit down and talk about what he was going through? And which he was pretty much okay with it. He didn't, he never was like holding it, say like, oh my God, I have this addiction, this is terrible. He was fine.
I'm in this fight, no, I'm not guilty. Hope the Most High can see my heart is in the right place. My hands are folded, my knees are bending when I say, God.
Well, you know, you, despite these 35 plus years of accomplishments, Raphael, you have always been a quiet, backseat sort of person, right? Not talking a lot about your personal life, not sharing a lot. You know, I mean, something in the Instagram era, right? Everybody's right. Online tweeting about themselves, you know, 24/7. What was the decision to write this album and share so much? I mean, it had to be a little weird.
Every time I make a record, I'm thinking about what style of music I wanted to create or what it should feel like. But this was more like what I felt like at the time. Mm-hmm. And it ends up being that with other records. Like, the way I see it, it was, you know, I got into the record a little bit, and then I figured out I was making a lot of 60s music after three or four records, and then I was okay, this is the vibe, and I just kind of went with it.
I promise I won't let you down. I'm gonna make you so proud.
Yeah. With Jimmy Lee, it was different. I had made maybe enough records to have two other albums, and then I started thinking about drug addiction, thinking about Jimmy, and I started thinking about, I've been going away from my family for, you know, 20, 30 years, like, yeah, really concentrating on music, and I see my family when I can. You know, my mom, I see my mom and my sister a lot, and I lost a lot of members in the family earlier on, so I felt like I've been consumed with myself and not them, and I think everybody was getting through, you know, life as best as they could, and I took my own route, they took their own route, and I felt like this should be a record that I can look to my mom, and, you know, I had lost my dad a year before I made this record. So I said, let me just make this record for us, for everybody, for the family, and go, okay, this is what has been going on, and we haven't really discussed it or ever talked about it. It's just something that happened, and we just dealt with it, and you know, by me calling Jimmy Lee, everybody sort of have to look at it and listen on their own terms. And I haven't still sat with anybody and see what they thought about it, except my nephew, whose dad is Jimmy Lee. So before I put the record out, I brought him to the studio, flew him down to L.A. and said, listen.
Yeah.
Something keeps calling. Thank you.
so his dad, I didn't want it to come out with him not doing it. So he was the only one. So I think it was more like a toast to the family to have some closure, and also for other families who have a Jimmy Lee in their lives, you know.
That's the key. Everybody, if the specifics aren't exactly matching up with your brother Jimmy Lee's, everybody has this in their family, people they love, or maybe themselves. So it becomes universal pretty quickly. And by the time you bring the sledgehammer down with Rikers towards the end of that, it's like, oh, he's talking about the world today, America today, everybody today.
Yeah, definitely. You know, Rikers was sort of like the end of the record, and I just started singing it because I used to visit Jimmy in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And
I saw a quote you said it was like Disneyland to me. I was a kid.
I was a kid. I thought I was going somewhere special because nobody told me.
Yeah.
And, you know, because, you know, it's like you pack up. It's like you're going fishing in the morning with your parents. You pack up, they get the tackle boxes together, everybody get in the car, and we're driving.
I get to have pop or whatever from the machine,
And then you drive up and you're in Santa Rita Prison, and you're like, okay. And the first time, you don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
The second time when you go back, it feels, you know, sort of special till you get there. And I looked at my brother and I'm like, okay, you ready to go? You ready to leave?
Yeah.
He's like, I can't leave. I'm in prison. And I'm like, this is not, you're not a celebrity. You're locked up.
Yeah.
And I read this book called Make Me Wanna Holler years ago. And the book was basically talking about how he noticed the incarceration percentage of people that were, you know, less, you know, fortunate. And he said, you know, you could look and see all the lawyers' cars on one side were like nice cars, and the other side of the parking lot was all these, you know, not too nice cars.
Lucky they made it there.
And so you could see how the system really works.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I start going, I start seeing, like, you know, most of these people are in prison for something they shouldn't be in prison for.
Yeah.
You know, for, you know, marijuana or... Mm-hmm. You know, an addiction. You know, if we were incarcerated for an addiction, for sugar, we'd all be gone.
Yeah. Everybody's got something.
I'm thinking.
Yeah, I got to quit smoking.
Me too. I laugh all the time because what happens, I did this little 30-day, it's like 41 days of not eating sugar, right?
Yeah.
10 days, I crapped out and was like, yeah, cookies. And then I said, that's when I thought about my brother, and I started laughing. I'm like, wow, I'm glad I never really told him to stop, but other people, I have done that. You should stop. Yeah. You need to stop. I'm like, man, here I am. I can't even stop eating like a donut.
Yeah,
I wish it was that
easy.
And
I'm telling somebody to stop, you know, capitalism and incarceration of prison is, it's an investment, you know. And you don't really know that because when you grow up, you did something bad, you're going to jail.
Yeah,
and everybody's sort of trained the same way. So when I came up with Rikers, it was like, it's just way too many people. It's way too crowded to the point they have to let, you know. I was reading this thing about in Colorado, there's like 9 to 10 prisons in a 4-mile radius of each other.
Small, right, very close proximity.
Yeah.
Like, so either are you going to work there? Or are you going?
Industry.
It's like General Motors.
That's town business, right?
It's a town business. Right. It's like crime does pay.
That was artist and producer Rafael Sadiq. As always, we want to hear from you. What is your favorite of Rafael Sadiq's many songs and why? Leave a message on our hotline with your opinion at 888-859-1800. Coming up, more with Rafael after a break on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. This week, our guest is singer, songwriter, bassist, multi-instrumentalist, producer, Rafael Sadiq. Perhaps most widely known as a member of the 1990s R&B band Tony, 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 he's released 5 critically acclaimed solo albums, all the while producing important work for other artists, including Lady by D'Angelo and Cranes in the Sky by Solange.
Lately, he's been busy scoring the television show Insecure and recording more of his solo work, some of which was released on 2019's Jimmy Lee. Sadiq recorded much more material than what eventually wound up on that album. So joined by our producer, Ayanna Contreras, I'm not gloating that you weren't there, Greg, but boy, that was a fun interview. I asked Raphael what his plans are for that other music.
After this record, I'm going to start putting out music every couple months, like you know, three songs here, three songs there, and start feeding, you know, not the machine, but just creative people who really want to hear what you do and see if people can, you know, if they can respect it and actually collect it. I'm going to try to figure out something that people can just, you know, can start collecting music, maybe making 45s, maybe making, put out a 45, which is two records out, and not put it out digital.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then, like, maybe put a couple of records out the next time digital and then kind of do a little mix. Start more of like a collector's team, like a book club.
Yeah. Yeah.
A book club for 45s.
And why are you looking at me like?
Because I knew that was going to get you super excited.
Well, yeah, because in front of me is like this stack of wax that you've put out. Some of it is solo stuff. Some of it is actually stuff that you've done for others, like Kissing You by Total, mm-hmm. which is one of my favorite songs. Mm. But the thing about you that I respect so much is how prolific you've been, be it solo, be it in group functions, be it producing other people's songwriting. I mean, it's incredible, like, just how much output you've had. I mean, yeah. In the beginning of this interview, Jim was talking about how influential you have been on the R&B sound in the past 30 years. I think sometimes people don't even realize, you know, because they don't have this 12-inch single with all of the liner notes on right. it to see, you know, all the different things that you've done.
Sometimes I forget, you know, things that I did, and because I sort of have this thing to put my head down and just work and just to create and keep learning from different people. So I think that's why. And I'm not, like you said, I'm not that vocal. I don't see myself as being a very quiet person. But my friends say, well, you sort of are. You don't have that vocal as you think. But I feel like when I do speak, I speak with music. So,
yeah, but you know what I'm talking about. You've won enough Grammys and know that kind of L.A. infrastructure.
I haven't really won that many Grammys. I've just worked with people that
have won Grammys.
That have won Grammys. I haven't really won a Grammy.
You've been in proximity enough to enough Grammys.
I've been in a room.
Right.
And I've been in a room, and I sort of like it that way. Because honestly, to be honest, I like to be branded as Raphael Sadiq, not as Grammy Award winning Raphael
Sadiq. Right. Oh, well, no. It's all BS anyway. But point was that there are so many songwriters and producers who walk around with their resume, you know, crowing about it all the time. One of the things I want to talk to you about as working with other artists is the diversity and the range. I mean, D'Angelo.
You should be here in the evening. Get the sneezing. Teasing, forget your reasons why you should not. Oh, lady, you should see the tricks that I got. Oh, for your mama
and Solange, but like Whitney Houston, you know, and TLC. What is it you think you bring to a room? I mean, some characters, you know, D'Angelo mystifies all of us, right?
Yeah.
You know, would seem to be really difficult and like, or just challenging because their vision is so strong. You've worked with so many different people. What is it about your personality that you are just able to collaborate with all these different types?
I think because I stayed a fan of the music before, like I said earlier, that I just really love music and, I like to call myself a utility type of musician. Like I could add on to what's needed when it's needed. I could be in the room and let another artist be the artist. Even though I'm an artist, I can step back and let another artist be who they are, and I could add to whatever they do. Well, D'Angelo is a he's a monster of his own, you know, and we're closer in art than anybody that I've ever worked with. Solange is next, but she's basically a producer. Yeah. So it sounds different because she's a producer. And I was in a room with her. I did what she asked me to do, and I have to give her 100% props.
She knew what space she wanted.
She's in a producer 100% on her own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people don't give her. I think she is getting the props now. She's a brain. I mean, I said sometime we work together, and I would just look at her and go, "That's what you really heard?"
Mm.
She's like, "Yeah, that's what I'm hearing." I was like, "Wow, that's amazing." And to me, that's like, that's going back to that thing when you hear a song, you hear something, you don't know how it happened, you just feel it.
Yeah.
Solange is that type of producer.
I tried to drink it away. I tried to put one in the air. I tried to dance it away. I tried to change it with my hair. I wear my credit card below. Thought a new dress would make it.
For me to work with someone like D'Angelo, Solange, Toto, even, you know, Mick Jagger, you know, any artist that I've ever worked with, I've been able to see what they're going to bring and what I'm going to bring and what I could bring that's going to help what they're doing. And also, I think musicians try to work with me, too, when they figure out they've done everything that's commercially valuable and they burnt out.
Yeah.
And they want quality, but they don't want it. Not feel like they're commercial, not be on the radio. I've figured it out where I can be commercial and keep the integrity, which is the hardest thing in this business to do, is to have a commercial record and not sell your soul.
That is a good trick. You're absolutely correct. You know, in the critical world, they talk so much about authenticity.
Yeah.
You know, is there anything that's really authentic? You know, John Lee Hooker, even at 85, is getting out of the limo with two beautiful babes, 20 years old, and suddenly he's on the back porch, you know, and he's stamping with his foot. You know, what's authentic? But you do bring a certain amount of soul and your Raphael personality to these records, but they sell. That's unusual.
Even though I'm quoted as an R&B soul, I'm totally not that. I'm just, there's nothing that I'm not.
Yeah.
So when people try to, even it's hard to be in a label because they don't really know how to label me.
You don't fit in that box.
Because if you do a 60s record and like the urban crowd basically didn't know I had an album on. I was in Europe for 5 years and I'll come to the States and they would go, when you put new music out? Like, bro, I've been touring off the same album for 5 years.
Yeah.
So Instant Vintage, they knew.
The first time I saw your thighs, that's when I realized my heart has skipped a beat. I can't seem to make you see. I tried everything in my book. I'm laughing cause you won't even look. I gotta stop wasting my time, so excuse me, please.
So when you work with John Cougar Mellencamp, they don't even know about that.
Yeah, yeah.
I was in Indiana for 3 months with him.
I'm so sorry.
So, I mean, people don't know. Work with the Bee Gees.
Yeah.
You know, people don't know.
I was talking to somebody about you, and it's true. It's almost like you've got two separate fan bases, and there's like a Venn diagram. There's some similarities, but yeah, there's the I love Instant Vintage, Get Involved, you know what I'm saying? Like that sound, Ray Ray, all that stuff.
Once we stop by here and walk upstairs and
but then there's the folks who were like the AAA people who were into
The Way I See It.
The Way I See It's All Rolling. But then for me, I feel like this Jimmy Lee almost converges the two.
Yeah.
I wake up, I call a man to see what's in the man's hands. He comes by and
when I came out with Instant Vintage and I came out with Ray Ray, I said I'm going to give everybody a soft pill to swallow with Ray Ray. I'm saying this is an independent record. I'm going to have some fun. Just pure fun.
Everyone buying her drinks. Everyone wants to know her. It's such a sexy show. And she's always dancing.
I need a chick like you that don't know when to quit.
I said, but the very next album, I'm going to let you know what I am and what I, the way I see it. How I've been hearing music as a kid. So like the first record I heard was How Sweet It Is to Be Loved by You, and Pride and Joy was a James Jamerson famous bass lines, and it was Motown.
How sweet it is to be loved by you. Yes, it is.
So the way I see it was stating to people, like, this is the way I've always heard music.
You can tell by the smile, she's such a love child. And every man in this place would love to be in her space.
I mean, Really Love That Girl is the most Motown-sounding song
that's true.
That I've ever heard that Motown
It's fun
do.
Sometimes.
Like, everything, you got that right.
I told Barry Gordy, I saw Barry Gordy one day. He didn't know me, he saw me twice, and I said, dude, honestly, I think I did the best Motown interpretation of what you guys did better than anybody. My name's Raphael Steele. And he looked at me, you know, I was like, yeah, I think I did.
No. I mean, when you think about it, because so many people have been trying to figure that out.
Yeah.
Like what that was, what the Funk Brothers were
Billy
doing.
Joel.
Yeah.
Everybody's had their Motown.
Yep.
And I was like, no, I did it.
You did that.
If I didn't do it, I would not be that bold to say it.
No, when you it don't came make out, idle boasts.
When it came out, when I did it and I heard the record back and I was listening, I was like, oh. I mean, I was like surprised.
She is so, so sweet and tender, and I'm glad, so glad I met a girl. She is so, so sweet and tender, and I'm glad, so glad I met a girl. Oh, I love that girl.
Well, what was the secret sauce?
I tell people, because, you know, I have a lot of gear. A friend of mine, Chuck Brungard, it's this kid. He's like, Chuck is this little white dude, chubby white dude that nobody believed in. And he had these friends who treated him really bad. And he was sweeping my floors. And I was saying, I want to do this Motown song on the record. And these other guys who were his friends told him, yeah, you can't do that. The wires are different. The building is just different.
Tubes, amps.
So one day it was just me and him in the studio. He was walking around. And he said, hey, man, you know, that sound you're talking about, I know what you're talking about. I think we could do it. And I was like, okay, let's try. And he is the one who mixed the album.
That mixes right.
Wow.
And he never mixed an album before.
But the other part, now remember I was talking about liner notes being important. I'm holding this 45 of Love That Girl in my hand, and I just noticed, I was about to say that you had that Jack Ashford sounding tambourine, but it's actually Jack Ashford of the Funk Brothers playing tambourine on that record.
It's Jack, yeah.
Yeah, so
well,
I
don't know. He played, and Paul Reiser.
Record.
Paul Reiser did all the strings.
Right, which, great arranger.
Which I talked to Paul the other night on the phone. I was in Detroit, and I talked to Paul Reiser. I just said, if I'm going to do this, I have to go get the guys who... And it was amazing. Like, when I played Sure Hope You Mean, and he was playing Vibes. And
amazing.
And I pushed record, and I said, maybe I should tell him to play it on the hook. And then I just stopped and was like, no, dude, it's been making records before I was born. And so I just waited. And when the song came on, he didn't play.
Yeah.
He waited. And then I started singing the verse, and then he played it on the verse. And it was like, you have to learn how to shut up.
Yeah.
your love I can never trade. There's something about you that shakes away my pain. See this heart of mine.
We have been talking to Rafael Sadiq, Ayanna Contreras, and I. It has been a complete and utter pleasure. Thank you, Rafael.
Thank you, too. Thank you. No problem.
That wraps up our conversation with Rafael Sadiq. Thank you, Ayanna Contreras, for helping me out there. Greg Kot, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, we've got a discussion about the evolution of sexual identity in music, talking about artists ranging from Little Richard to Elton John.
You can download Sound Opinions wherever you get your podcast thingies. We're all listening to a lot of podcasts these days. As always, the show was produced by Brendan Banizak, Alex Claiborne, Ayanna Contreras, and Andrew Gill.
Winter, spring, summer, or fall, all you've got to do is call, and I'll be there. You've got a friend.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic, so give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
New messages.
Hey, this is Lee calling from week 3 of quarantine in Brooklyn. Just appreciating the simple things in life. Songs for isolation. Right now it's Chores by Animal Collective. Just going to share these lyrics. I got these chores.
Now I got these chores and I'm going to hurt no one.
And when at last my work is done, I only want the time to do one thing that I like.
I want to get so strong.
Take a walk. Out in a light drizzle at the end of the day when there's no one watching. So, you know, we do what we can, we get by. Thinking of you all and praying for sanity. See you soon.
Hey, Jim and Greg, this is Justin in Michigan. Just wanted to call to say two things. One, really appreciate you guys continuing to do the show even during these hard times. It's great to open up my podcast on a Friday and see you guys are still there to listen to. And second, I saw that Adam Schlesinger from Fountains of Wayne passed away from COVID, and I was really sad to see that, but also wanted to nominate another song for the Desert Island Jukebox, Mexican Wine, Fountains of Wayne.
He was killed by a cellular phone explosion. They scattered his ashes across the ocean.
Great song. Lyrics are kind of nonsense, but I think they mean that life's unfair sometimes and you gotta just enjoy it while you can. So crack open a bottle of Mexican wine and hope you guys are doing well and stay healthy.
In the summertime, I'll be yours if you'll be mine. I tried to change, but I changed my mind. Think I'll have another glass of Mexican wine.
Hi guys, this is Tom, social distancing in Lino Lakes, Minnesota. Just calling to talk about your record review roundup show. Three things, and I promise to do them quickly. One, I loved your review of the band Rookie.
I like your son, glasses, she's a renegade on rollerblades.
As an unabashed fan of Thin Lizzy and of course The Replacements, I intend to listen to it very soon. Never heard the story about the Masked Marauders. What a great story. Nobody enjoys a great hoax more than me, long as nobody gets hurt. And what a fantastic hoax that must have been. And number three, the fake Beatles band that you called Klaatu. As any science fiction fan knows, it would be pronounced Klaatu. Klaatu Barada Nikto. Bye.
Carol from Chapel Hill. Jim, no good songs with rock and roll in the title. I've listened for a long time and wanted to call, but I can't let that one slide on by me. I Love Rock and Roll by Joan Jett. The lead singer from the Arrows just passed away recently from the coronavirus, and he said he wrote the song in reaction to the Rolling Stones' It's Only Rock and Roll, which is number two on my list. Number three, Patti Smith's, a song I'll paraphrase the title of, is Rock and Roll, the N-Word. 4, Nick Lowe, I Knew the Bride When She Used to Rock and Roll. 5, Grand Funk Railroad's Rock and Roll Souls. 6, Rock and Roll Led Zeppelin. 7, The All-American Boy, Rick Derringer himself, Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo. 8, Huey Lewis in the News, The Heart of Rock and Roll Is Still Beating. I know, Huey Lewis in the News, but I appreciate him a lot more after American Psycho. 9,
no more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.
12, City's Own Flame with Rock and Roll, The Blue Oyster Cult. And my last two are Rock and Roll Children and The King of Rock and Roll by Ronnie James Dio. Now, Jim, if you don't like any of those, maybe you just don't like rock and roll.